Hello!
Hello.
And welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats, and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. I'm Sam Michka.
I'm Alex Gellner.
And this week we are doing something a little different. So instead of looking at a play about the Holocaust, we're exploring a part of Jewish culture that was nearly completely lost during the Holocaust. It revolves around story, community, and human connections, and we are delighted to have Shonalee Cumbers joining us in the Zoom studio. Shonalee, welcome to the pod.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Honestly, I'm so excited. I'm like a big kid. You know, I always am when I'm anywhere near. Seriously, Shonalee is the only person in the world who can unleash my inner 7-year-old. This is going to be epic. We'd like to whet people's appetites before we go into the disclaimers. So, can you give us a one-line summary of what we will cryptically refer to now as the tradition?
Oh gosh, a one-line summary.
Just to whet people's appetite.
A women's oral tradition passed from grandmother to granddaughter as a way to survive and know who you are.
I just told that, right?
Beautiful. So now that we've given you a hint and whetted your appetite, it's time for the disclaimers.
Number one, Alex and I work for external organizations, but this podcast is entirely on us. We do not represent our employers in this capacity. We are not speaking for them. This is our baby. So if you don't like something you hear, blame us. And also, please leave Shonalee out of it.
Please. Number two, as we know, the Holocaust is a deeply dark subject. So, because we work with it every day, we do use humor as a coping mechanism, but we are not mocking the Holocaust. We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humor at times. So, please bear this in mind while listening. Be spiritually generous. Thank you.
And number three is our rule of engagement. If you have questions, a suggestion for an episode, a correction, a comment, feedback for us on anything that you've heard or anything that we've said, you can find the contact details in the show notes. And depending on the platform, you can also comment directly on the episode.
All right. Some of us may have, you may have skipped. That's okay. But now you can stop skipping. Thank you. All right, Sam, shall we?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So, if you're a listener who's already familiar with Shonalee and her work, you'll know that this week we're looking at the Dritzla storytelling tradition. To start the conversation, Shonalee, would you like to tell us what a Dritzla is?
Gosh, well, stop me if I talk too much.
Never.
Dritzilla is its derivative of the word Dritzela, which is storyteller, but a dritzilla is female. It was peculiar to the Netherlands or the lowlands of Europe. It was a storytelling in communities passed down from grandmother to granddaughter. It was a series of learning and remembering, but also many, many stories that were told in cycles. That were just told over and over again, and they are interlaced and interlocked, and they were just passed down, grandmother to granddaughter, orally. It's an oral tradition. I think primarily because, hundreds of years ago, women didn't read and write, so they had to find a way to preserve and pass on, hence all the exercises and the drashing and everything else.
So, what is, you use the word they're drashing. What
It's
is.
short for midrash. It's different from a rabbinical midrash. Midrash really just means to unpeel, to reveal what is hidden in plain sight through a series of questions. And it's a very common practice within rabbinical practice, so male commentary that you find by, that's why they call us the people of the book, have an idea, tell a story, ask questions, write a book, ask questions of the book, produce another book, and so on and so forth. But the Drizila Midrash or Drash is more a creative process. It's a way of looking at narrative and storytelling and story specifically to ask questions of it through a numerous sort of exercises and viewpoints to see what's hidden in plain sight. And thus you don't just know the story, it's as if you have experienced the story. It's as if the story is a companion that you've walked with. And I think that explains when I say the drash.
And you said that it's essentially the female tradition, and it's passed on from grandmother to granddaughter.
Yep.
So your grandmother passed the tradition on to you?
Indeed, she did, yes, but in rather different circumstances than would normally have happened. It would have happened within the towns and the places where people lived. But obviously, there were various hiccups, the First World War, the Second World War. And so, when I was 4 years old, my bubba, my grandmother, was living with us, having survived. The communities where these stories would have been told were extinct. They didn't exist anymore. So you had a tradition that was so common that it wasn't even really, the thought of preserving it was ridiculous. It was like, oh, shall I preserve this plastic cup? It was that common. But in the space of about 5 years during the Second World War, it virtually went extinct. Because obviously, if you're a little old Dutch lady living in the Netherlands, your prospects aren't too good. Bubba survived. My mother had come over to the UK on one of the last Kinder transports, but illegally. Don't tell Farage. And she was living with us when I was four, and she taught me traditionally, because you'd start when you're 4 years old. You don't realize you're learning anything. You just think you're playing a series of games to start with. And she just poured it into me. And I don't know why she did. Maybe because the communities that I could share with didn't exist anymore, so I could never practice as a traditional Drizila. But I think maybe it was a form of therapy, maybe it was a form of wanting just to give me an insight, because culturally it doesn't exist really anymore. And one of the things that Hitler wanted to do was wipe out culture. And it was a very strong cultural thing. But she just poured it into me, and I didn't really understand what was happening for a while. I just loved it. I got to spend time with my bubba. I got to play. I got to hear all these amazing stories, and it just slowly dawned on me what was happening over the years. But I loved it, all except once.
Is that another story for another time, or
It's a stupid thing. It's childhood, really. I was about six, and I wanted to play. And I wanted to go outside and play. We were right in the middle of learning this story, and I said, well, I teach now, so I knew, I know what Bubba was thinking. If I went out and played at that point, we'd have to go back to the beginning. She wanted me to finish this particular exercise, and like all 6-year-olds, it was sunny and it was nice, and I wanted to go and play. And we were doing a story about a mountain, and what she did, which looking back was amazingly creative, she got my dad to bring in the slide into the house, and we had it
Oh,
on. So while she was teaching me, I was climbing up this slide and sliding down it,
oh.
and looking back, I must have been very young, because I looked at that slide now and I'm only 5 foot and my head is level with it. But at the time, it seemed like this enormous mountain, and suddenly this story took on another dimension. So that was her being clever, her using the drash, and just being really canny and not giving up. But most of the time, absolutely loved it.
Love that. So, were there any other sort of creative processes or techniques that she snuck in while she was teaching you?
Well, the whole sort of process is like that. You walk stories, you learn the drash. One of the things I remember is when I was we were in England by then, and she was teaching me the story, and it's I think if you look, it is actually recorded in some Jewish folklore books as the Wooden Sword, and she was teaching me this story, and we were walking through the woods. And looking back, she must have set it up beforehand, you know, because her friend was married to the local ghillie, the local woods, the guy that looked after the woods for the council. And as a result of that, they had a cottage in the middle of the woods. And we were walking through, and it was just getting dusk. And she was telling me this story. And we just got to a bit where the king knocked on the woodcutter's door, and we're peering in this window. And I looked at this cottage, and it looked like the most magical cottage in the world. It had a tree growing up through the middle of it. And she
Oh
said, "Do you want to hear the rest of the story?" And I went, "Yes."
no.
And so she said, "We'll knock on the door and ask the woodcutter," which was like, oh my goodness. So I knocked on the door, and he let me in, and him and his wife, we sat down and we had a bowl of stew like they do in the story, and he told me the next bit of the story, and we walked home that night, and by now the stars and the moon were out, and it was just absolutely magical. And then she told me the rest of the story. And this is why you should never go back. Years later, I went back, and of course, life had moved on. He was no longer there. He probably, you know, graduated, as we say. And I looked through the window, and it wasn't a tree. It was a spiral staircase that had been built around a tree trunk. But my sort of 5, 6-year-old brain had seen this tree, and of course, it
Wow.
wasn't. I thought, oh, sometimes you shouldn't go back. And then a few years ago, we happened to be in my home village, and I was t Simon knew this story, that's my husband, and he said, "Oh, I'll go and look." And I went, "Oh, I don't want to. I'll sit in the pub while you go and have a look." And he came back, but because he knew the story and all of the sort of stories around it, he came back and he went, "It's still there. The cottage is still there." Then I looked through the window, and for him it was magical because he'd just discovered it, you know. So yeah, so that's
Oh.
the sort of thing she used to do, because she believed stories should be like memories when you tell them. They shouldn't be performed like smoke and mirrors. They should be just told like a memory.
It's
And
beautiful.
you've talked about the stories. Now I say obviously I know about the cycles and the stories because I'm a proper fangirl. But just, I think, how long have we known? We've known each other 13 years now.
Something like that,
Where has my life gone? I regret nothing.
yeah.
But in terms of the when we talk about cycles and stories, what are the cycles? How many stories are there? You can probably see where I'm leading because how do they interlink? Because you've already spoken about the fact that they interlink, and this is one of the things that I find so wonderful about the tradition, and I want to share with everybody. So please tell
Okay.
us.
Well, you start off, you have 12 cycles of stories, and each cycle is named after a rabbi. The cycle has got nothing to do with that rabbi at all. It's merely a geographical date stamp, if you like. Much like the British Library names a lot of its book collections after emperors, Roman emperors. They've got nothing to do with the Roman emperors. It's just when it was donated, there was a bust of Nero on the end of each one. So they got, oh, that's the Nero connection. And so the rabbis give their names to the cycles, although they don't really have anything to do with the stories that are inside them. So, for example, you have the cycle of Manasseh. And what that tells us is Manasseh was fairly famous around about 1600s in the Netherlands, but also in the UK. He was the rabbi that was responsible for persuading Cromwell to let the Jews back in to England. So he's got a fairly sort of high profile, he's fairly significant. So that gives us a date stamp for all the stories in that cycle were probably gathered around 1600, although a lot of them are much earlier. You can find them in the Mishnah or the Gemara or the Talmud. And they are located round about Europe. So it gives you that idea, primarily the Netherlands. Within each cycle, you have about eight sub-cycles. So within the cycle of Manasseh, you have the Ruby Tree, the Diamond Girl and the Goat Hornby, the Opal Forest, the Emerald Sea, the Sapphire Staff, Tobias and the Snow Tear, the Cloth of Hope and Sorrow, and the Ten Wonderful Things. Within each one of those sub-cycles, there can be anything between 120 to 300 stories, depending. I've never counted them. My husband is a folklorist and is desperately counting them and getting very excited and following me around with a microphone, though not in a creepy way. So there's a lot of stories. The interesting thing is I work with tradition bearers all over the world. There's about 4,000. Now, if you're working with texts, that sounds like a lot of stories. But if you're working with oral communities, it's about average for people that work orally. So when I work with, there's a group called the Wisdom of the Grandmothers that I've been let into, even though I'm not a grandmother. But when I work with people like that, they'll go, "Oh, never mind, love. You'll learn more as you get older." Whereas if you say it to a Western world, I know about 4,000 stories in my head. They go, "Oh my God, that's amazing. You're so incredible." You're not. It's normal for an oral tradition. So that's the kind of amount of the stories. How do they interlink? Well, for example, in the Ruby Tree, you start the story starts with a prince called Cebus who wants to marry a commoner who sends him off on all these quests, and they get married and they have a child, and then the story starts with them looking after their grandchild, who's Ben-Burim Cebus. And you've met a guy called Tobias, who's a goat herder, you meet a mashef, you meet another family, and the people that you meet in one story as main characters might be a bit part in another subcycle. So, for instance, Tobias is a throwaway in the Ruby Tree. He's a 7-year-old boy who teaches a prince how to herd goats. But then you have Tobias and the Snow Tear, where he's a major character in the story. You see them age, you see them grow older, you follow them, and the incredible thing is that the stories all intertwine, and interlink. So you'll meet First Dog as a glancing reference, or you'll meet a woman who doesn't age as a glancing reference, and then she's a major character in the Sapphire Staff. It's Judith, so who kills Holofernes. So all of these characters kind of dance in and out of this world in a very real way. Somebody once said to me, although I've never seen it, and I felt slightly insulted, but I have no logical reason for that. They went, "Oh my God, listening to this, it's better than Game of Thrones." Now, I've never heard Game of Thrones, but I wasn't particularly flattered by the analogy, which is a shame, really. Maybe I should watch it. Maybe I'm being just a little oversensitive.
No, I'm insulted on your behalf, and I can't pinpoint exactly why. I'm like,
I mean, of course. I mean, I can expect. I assume they didn't. Of course, they didn't mean it as an insult because clearly Game of Thrones
Oh,
is something
God,
that
no.
they
Yeah.
love very, very much, and it's. I think it sounds like it's they made a connection with like just the lore and the just all the yeah,
the
the excitement
complexity.
in those stories. It's a very, you know, they're very human stories and fantastical worlds. And that's my little Parks and Rec reference.
Oh, I'm sure they did. They were a lovely person, and they were completely, as you say, they were in the world of the story. And as I say, I've never seen it. I've no idea why I felt like that. I think it's because I'm unreasonably prejudiced against mass-produced television shows. It's probably that. Because I can be quite small-minded and petty at times, so you have all these interlinking worlds that can take days, months to tell, and you'll have phrases which goes, but that's another story for another time, and the listener has to ask for it, or you'll have a phrase that says, but that's more stories than I can tell you, because if you go down that path, you'd swap sub-cycles and. So I use that more than my bubble would have done traditionally because I work on stage and I work in sort of ended sessions, as in you start on the Friday, you end on the Sunday, and you can't go meandering down all these paths because you'd never have the satisfaction of finishing one, and that would be very frustrating for the people that are there. Whereas my bubba didn't need to do that because she was telling to a community that would be there night after night after night. And we get that with Twilight Tales, very much got that feel about it, that vibe, where you can just take as long as you want and go wherever you want. So yes, they're worlds within worlds within worlds. In fact, I was a weird kid when I was young. They were my friends. I had all the imaginary friends I could ever want. So yeah, does that answer your question?
I would say so,
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. So just because I'm coming into this very very green and then not knowing anything. So how long is would a cycle take to tell and the sub cycles within them? How long does it usually
The
take?
sub-cycles would vary, but I can give you a fairly accurate from the recordings we did on Twilight Tales. So, as I said, my husband is a folklorist, and for a long time, I'm going to approach this question rather circuitously. Bear with me. For a long time, my husband used to worry that most of these stories weren't written down, and you could find very little reference to them, if none at all. And then, quite impressively, because he's Quaker and not Jewish at all, he got on board with the whole Jewish guilt thing. So, what are you going to do about it? You're going to record them. What are you going to do? And I went, well, I don't know really. And he went, so when you do graduate and pass over, you perfectly happy to tell your bubba that an entire tradition died with you because you couldn't possibly bother to record it. And there was a part of me that thought, that's so impressive that you've embraced that emotional blackmail in such an incredible way, marvelous. Then my son chimed in by saying, yes, because if you cark it, which is Yorkshire slang for dying suddenly, if you cark it, they're gone, aren't they? So I'd gone from sort of telling the odd one or two, but not really thinking about it, to thinking, oh my Lord, I've got to do something about this. And we started by telling them at festivals and performances, but it wasn't long enough. You couldn't really, you'd have to pick one story. You couldn't do it as it was done. And then we started doing a thing called Tellers, Tales and Tradition Weekends, which were sought up by a lovely woman who's a textile artist, actually, called Deborah Barker. And she said, why don't we do that? And I said, well, I don't think people might want to come and listen to me for an entire weekend. That's quite heavy listening. But people did. They just kept coming and we kept doing them. And again, they were a great way. It helped the recording of them so much more. But it still wasn't enough to get them all down. So my husband said, well, how did your bubba do it? And I said, well, every night after we'd had our tea, as we say up here, after we'd had us tea, we would sit down and we'd she'd tell me a story, and it could last for an hour or whatever, and it would be the story we were working on or the next stage of a story. And sometimes it would just be her and me listening, and sometimes it would be her and me and the cat, and sometimes there'd be neighbours, and it didn't matter. Or high holy days, there'd be more people there. And he said, "Well, why don't we do that? Why don't we sit down each evening and you tell the next bit, and I'll record it?" And I said, "Because we won't do it. Because we'll always find a reason why. Oh, I feel tired. I've got a headache. Oh, I want to watch this Netflix series." So what we came up with was a very good wheeze, actually. We thought we'll make ourselves accountable. If we're accountable, we're going to have to do it. So we just put a little message out to a small group of friends that said, "We're going to do a thing called Twilight Tales." And back in the day, we'd started at 6. We do it at 6:30 now, but that's irrelevant. At 6 o'clock, for about half an hour, 45 minutes, so that we can record these stories. Here's a link. It's not going to cost you anything. You're welcome to come. And we'd put the link out to about 20 people, and we thought, and we'd said, if you know anyone, we didn't want to advertise it because you probably, if you advertise something and it's free and it's got a Jewish cultural basis, you're going to get at least two trolls, and I couldn't be bothered with that. So we said, pass it on to anyone you think might want to listen. And we logged on the first night, and the first night was January the 4th, 2021, at the height of COVID, expecting seven or eight people to be there, and there was nearly 80 people on the Zoom. So we thought, whoa. And we started with the Ruby Tree, and we told and we told. And in answer to your question, it took us 1 year, 2 months, and 2 weeks to tell the whole cycle, doing it every single night. So that entire cycle, from the Ruby Tree through to the 10 Wonderful Things, took us just over a year and 2 months and a couple of weeks. And it was great. It was just incredible. To tell a cycle, it can take anything from, if I'm doing it on the Twilight Tales module, anything from a month to 2 months. But if you look at it in terms of hours, I suppose each cycle, if you started and didn't stop and just kept going, you're looking at between 36 and 48 hours solid for each cycle. It just depends, because some have got shorter stories in, some have more complex arcs. So, example, in another cycle, you've got the Song of Lilith, and you've got the main story, and you've got all of Lilith's story and all of the matriarch story, but you also have the giant wars, all of the stories with the giant wars. You also have this place called the City of Shadows and Magic, which is a city of women, and there's 27 doors. So you have, and each door is a story that Lilith is involved with, and they can take 2 or 3 nights to tell just on their own. So that took us nearly 4 months to tell. So yeah, it's fun. And my husband, who is like ecstatic, I've never seen anyone get so ecstatic over paper before. He is a professor, so he's like, "Look, I have transcribed this. It's this thick. There's over a million words." And gets very happy about that.
And
I'm
how
so
would this?
this.
grateful. I'm sorry. I'm so grateful that that you both so he's also very invested because as he said, like this we have to find a way to preserve it. Is there any, and I'm just gonna be a little nerdy. So what is there a particular reason it skips the mother?
Yes, it doesn't skip. My mother learnt off of her grandmother. So you're doing it alternately. And I think there's two reasons for that. And one
Okay.
is an incredibly practical reason. If you're part of a traditional Jewish family, especially back in the day, as a mother, you'd probably be wrangling about 12 children. You wouldn't have time to teach somebody, but a grandmother would. So that's one reason, very practical reason. And Bubba did a lot of her teaching while she was cooking or making bread or washing up or doing the laundry. It's very, very family and to say simple, but it's about learning something while you're doing something else. Does that make sense? Because Bubby used to say, I mean, she meant from your conscious and your unconscious. She said, all of the best stories sit in the back brain, but your front brain's too busy talking. It never shuts up. You've got to give your back brain a chance. So she would do things while you're doing the laundry or while you're making bed because that occupies your front brain. So your back brain blah, blah, can work on things. And the other reason I think is slightly more nuanced is if you think about it, especially as women, we have a very different relationship to our grandmothers than we do to our mothers. You know, my mother was a career woman. We clashed all the time. But my Bubba and I, we just bimbled along and, you know, I loved her dearly. I love my mum as well, but you have a different relationship. There's more tolerance, there's more time, there's just a different energy between granddaughter and grandmother than there is between mother and daughter, I think.
Oh, that's beautiful. Wow, thank you. Yeah, I don't know why I had it in my mind. I'm like, is there an in are there like spots of generations of women that aren't that don't wear it? But that's
I think
what a
that's a
relief for wanting to hear that.
really good question. And interestingly enough, I think sometimes that we're not saving a whole tradition. We're probably only saving 2/3 of it because my mum had stories that I don't have. And so that makes me think maybe we're not saving a whole tradition. Maybe we've only got 2/3 of it. Who knows? But I don't know. There's a lot I don't know because my Bubba died when I was about 19. And when you're 19, you don't think to ask questions. I get asked questions these days, and I just have to turn around and I feel such an idiot going, I just don't know. Because I never thought to ask. Because you don't when you're younger, do you? The things that you don't ask. So I have many regrets about that. So if you're listening, talk to your grandparents, ask them questions, because you never know when you're going to regret that you didn't.
I think that also leads into another question that I have, which is what are some of the biggest challenges that you have faced or do face as a Drusilla?
Let me think. I think they fall into two categories, or maybe more. Who knows? Maths was never my strong point. I think one of the things was finding a place where these stories could breathe again properly. Because the modern storytelling, I'm doing air brackets if you can't, world hasn't got the patience or the time. Yeah, I look at a lot of modern storytelling and it's either personal anecdotes or it's stand-up comedy or it's quick little sound bites. Yeah, there isn't the time to journey through these worlds. And it's more narrative than storytelling, and storytelling has this slower pace to it. I don't mean in a slow delivery, but you can build a world and take people through it. So finding places where we could do this was really, really hard. I remember one incredibly well-meaning festival saying, we really want you to do, I can't remember what it was, I think it was the Diamond Girl. And I would normally do a 90-minute session for them. So I said, okay, well, that's great. I'm probably going to need 3 sessions, though. And in my mind, they were going to give me 3 90-minute sessions, and I thought, I won't be able to tell it all, but I can, you know, give a good wedge of it out there. And when I arrived at the festival, they said very happily, "We've given you 3 sessions," and I went, "Oh, fabulous, fabulous!" And what I got was 3 20-minute sessions, so I'd actually got less time than
Oh
if I'd taken a
no.
90-minute session. And I just thought, I can't do it. I can't do it in 3 20-minute sessions. It would be better to do 60 minutes and just do a basic story arc of it. And they meant well, but it's one of those things, if you haven't seen it, if you haven't heard it, it's really hard to understand the mechanics and the shape of it, I think, and the feel of it. So what I realized very quickly was there was no way on the modern circuit where I could do this. I had to create my own spaces, which is what I do now. I create spaces where I can go and do tellers' tales and tradition. I create online events. I teach, and when I teach my students over a month, I'll tell a story each night, bit of a story. So I create my own spaces. So that was the first thing, realizing that actually, when I went to festivals and did performances, I did a performance last night where you're a bachente, a wedding teller, basically. A bachente is a perform, what people would call a performance storyteller. Which always strikes me as weird, why you need to put the word performance in front of it, because I think it demeans the art of storytelling. If people don't know it's supposed to be entertaining, putting the word performance in front isn't going to help. Anyway, rant over. Sorry. What I do at festivals and places is I bachente it. I'll take one story and I'll absolutely kind of performance it up. Because that's fun to do as well, I'm not going to knock that. That's great fun to do. If I was just doing that, I would find it very unsatisfying. But what that does is people go, "Oh, that was really interesting," and then you can go, "Oh, we'll come to Twilight Tales, or we're doing a TTT near you," and they get a sense of it. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is disbelief. I meet a lot of disbelief, always, and I hate to say this. White middle class academics, usually elderly men.
Shocking.
Nobody could know that many stories.
Yeah, can't say that surprises me.
I've never heard of her, therefore she's made it all up. And as my husband, who is a renowned folklorist and an author, said, if you just listen to it, you can tell it's the work of many voices over many generations. You've heard it, Sam. It's the intricacy and the nature of it. And I always think it used to upset me when I was younger, because these would always be from people that had never heard it. And when I was younger and feistier, I'd go, "Well, I've never heard of you, so meh." And it's like, I'm not looking to get famous. I'm not looking to make a living, make a fortune. I am looking to make a living. Make a fortune. I just want to preserve a tradition. That's all I want to do. And but so you do meet that from academia, but actually, as I got older, I thought I don't need permission for academia to exist. I know who I am. I know who my tr what my tradition is. And actually, if I did make it up, I'd be a bloody genius. So I'm not going to get upset. I'm going to take it as a compliment that they think I'm a genius. And when I said that to one academic, he got very upset. And he said, "Well, you probably haven't, which was just hilarious. I'd also be a lot richer because I could copyright everything. But anyway, so that's another thing. And I suppose the last thing is, in the storytelling world, people want stories. Everybody wants material. And if you're a traditional storyteller, you're fishing, all fishing from the same pool. It's usually sort of Northern European fairy stories, Grimm's, the Kalevala, the Pankatant, all of these well-known works of story. And of course, this comes along, and there's a lot of stories people have never heard. And saying to people, "Could you not tell these till I've got a source for them, till I've put them in a book, so there's a source." And it was very, very hard to get people to understand that I wasn't gatekeeping, but because they are so intricate, and there's bits of halakhic lore in there, there's bits of stuff that is so embedded in culture that has almost been lost, that without a reference point, it's going to get twisted out of shape, and what it is will get lost. So, for example, two examples I'll give you, if that's all right.
Of course.
One lovely lady kept following me around at a festival saying, "Can I tell the ruby tree? Can I tell the ruby tree? Can I tell the ruby tree?" And I kept saying, "Well, I've only just started telling it. It's still new. In the format, I'd always told it as little bits, but it's the first time I've really done that, and we're putting it out as a book, so I'd rather you didn't. Once it's in a book, you can do what you want with it because there's a reference for it." But she kept on and on and on, and it was a week-long festival, and in the end I said, "Why do you want to tell this so desperately?" And she said, "Well, I work for the Anne Frank Museum, and there is a tree outside that we call the Ruby Tree. It's always been there. It was replanted after the war, but nobody knows why it's called the Ruby Tree." And listening to the Ruby Tree, and as well, you'll know it's about the lost generations, Sam, I realise why it's called the Ruby Tree. And I'm thinking, well, that's actually a very good reason. And then she said, "I just want to sit under it and tell it to the visitors." So I said, "All right, then, I'll just give you the basic. I won't give you any of the what we call ASFATs, other stories for other times. I'll just give you the basic as long as you promise me that's all you're going to do." And she went, Yes, that's what I'm going to do with it." So I spent like 2 days teaching her this. 6 months later, I got an email going, "You'll be thrilled to know I've put the Ruby Tree in a book." I wasn't thrilled.
Oh
I was. Well, I can't say what I was feeling because this is a podcast, but let's just say I was extremely miffed. And I went back to her and I said, "I'm not pleased and I don't really know how to talk to you right now." Now, she didn't do it out of nastiness, she did it out of ignorance. One of the things that she'd done is taken this tree, which represents life, with its roots that go down and drink from the river Pishon that flows from, paradise, that is cursed by a mashef, by a witch, that traps the souls of unborn children, which is a direct sort of metaphor for all of the children that were never born after any sort of Shoah. This amazing metaphor for life and death. And she had said, "But I've made it a tree of bones because children like that so much better." And I couldn't speak to her for a while. And in the end, when I did tell her how I felt, she was terribly upset because she hadn't done it nastily, she'd done it out of ignorance. And then another example I had was this very well-meaning middle class gentleman in the south of England. I was telling the Diamond Girl and the Goat Hornby, and there's a moment where when she cries, diamonds, raw diamonds, pour out of her mouth, which is painful, you can imagine. And her father says to her one day, "Never let anyone see the result of your sorrow. When they realize the wealth of it, your life will not be worth living." And it's a really powerful story, a story about women and how abuse and all of these things. But also in Jewish culture, there's 32 stories about pearls. Pearls come from the eyes because that's the gift that the Creator gave Lilith and Adam and Hava when they left paradise. But this very well-meaning gentleman, I told the Diamond Girl, and then we were sitting having a drink afterwards, and he said, "That was a lovely story," he said. "I really loved that, but of course, you did make a mistake." And it's oral storytelling, and you do get caught up in the moment, and I do make mistakes sometimes. I'll misname somebody or whatever. So I said, "Oh my gosh, what did I do wrong?" And he said, "Well, you had the tear that the diamonds pouring out of her mouth. Well, obviously they come out of the eyes with the tears." And I went, "No, they don't. That's a European thing. That's the thing from European and Northern European secular storytelling. I said, but in Jewish storytelling, they come out of the mouth. They're uncut. They're all the words you can't say. They're all the pain you've got to swallow. And if I come out of the eyes, then what happens to the stories about the pearls? I said, you lose them. Because what he actually said is, so when I tell it, I'll have. And I went, I don't think you're going to be telling it, sir. So you get that kind of entitlement where and I am teaching the stories to a lot of people now, but they're people that know how to drash. They understand the culture, they understand the Jewish references, and they are so wonderful and respectful. And they're telling in their own voice and in their own way, but they understand the way markers, the things that are important to be there and that. So I would have said in that's a terribly long-winded answer to your question. Those are the main problems that I have today. But the actual joy of telling and seeing the results of it that people have and the connections that people make far outweigh any of that, really.
So there's a particular story that we want to talk about today called The Fall of the Warsaw Ghetto. And as you know, we're doing things a bit differently in this episode because I've seen Shona Lee tell the story live, but it was many moons ago. Alex hasn't seen or heard it. To be honest, I'm a little bit jealous because that means you get to hear it for the first time and it's mind-blowing. We have the CD of it, and so what we're doing is recording this part of the episode with Shona Lee, and then through the wonders of technology, Alex and I are going to listen to the CD together while we're about 3,500 miles apart, and then we're going to come back to talk about our reactions. But as we try to do with all of our episodes, as you know, we want to give a bit of historical context to what we're talking about, which in this case is the Warsaw Ghetto. So I've drawn on two key resources, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's article on Warsaw and the Wiener Holocaust Library's case study Warsaw Ghetto on their website, The Holocaust Explained. And as usual, these and the rest of the sources can be found in our show notes. So, prior to the Second World War, Warsaw was the capital of Poland. The city had 1.3 million inhabitants, of which just over 380,000 were Jewish, and this was the largest Jewish community in Europe at the time. The Nazis occupied Warsaw on the 29th of September 1939, 4 weeks after they invaded Poland. And the Jewish population in Warsaw had grown following orders to concentrate Jews in cities and towns, but the ghetto itself wasn't decreed until the 12th of October 1940, which coincides with when, round about the time we're actually releasing this episode. The German authorities sealed the ghetto off from the rest of the city in November 1940. It was enclosed with a wall that was over 10 feet high, topped with barbed wire. Closely guarded, and the population was estimated to be over 400,000 Jews. So the Nazis forced the residents of the ghetto into an area of 1.3 square miles, which meant that there was an average of just over seven people per room. There was a Jewish council or a Judenrat who administered the ghetto and did so at the jurisdiction and orders of the Nazis. And the Warsaw Judenrat was led by a Jewish engineer called Adam Cherniakov. In October 1939, forced labour was made compulsory for all Jewish men and boys aged 14 to 60. And this was extended to men and boys aged 12 to 60 in January 1940. As the war continued, the Nazis realised that they had cheap, well, basically free labour in the occupants of the ghetto, doing things such as construction work. And by the summer of 1940, the Judenrat was being asked to supply lists of all the able-bodied Jewish men to work in the labour camps. And any failure to supply the amount of men asked for resulted in random roundups in the streets. Unsurprisingly, conditions in the camps were abysmal, and men either died there or came back extremely traumatized. So, with over 400,000 people in an area of 1.3 square miles, hygiene was a massive issue. There was very little running water, and soap was almost non-existent. There were several Jewish organizations inside the ghetto who were trying to essentially keep alive a population that suffered severely from starvation, exposure, and infectious disease. The amount of food allowed by the Nazis just simply wasn't sufficient to sustain life. So in 1941, the average Jew in the Warsaw Ghetto was living on 1,125 calories a day. But there was widespread smuggling of food and medicines to try and keep the horrific death rate from increasing further. However, some inhabitants were determined to continue cultural aspects in spite of the situation that they were in. Education was banned at almost all levels, but there were still schools. Adults could attend seminars and lectures, often led by those at the top of their field. Until 1942, there were Jewish bookstores in the ghetto, and there were also several theatres, as well as artists, musicians, bands, and writers who published covertly. Then from July until September 1942, German SS and police units, assisted by auxiliaries, carried out mass deportations from the Warsaw Ghetto to the killing centre at Treblinka. During this period, approximately 265,000 Jews were deported, and around 35,000 Jews were killed inside the ghetto during the operation. Rather than fill the daily quotas for deportation, Judenrat Chernyakhov died by suicide on July the 23rd. Then in January 1943, the SS and police units returned to the ghetto, this time with the intent of deporting thousands of there were approximately 60,000 Jews still left in the ghetto to forced labour camps in Lublin. But this time, a lot of the Jews, understandably believing that the SS were going to deport them to Treblinka to be killed, resisted, and some of them were actually able to use small arms smuggled into the ghetto. The SS and the police units were actually forced to halt the operation and withdraw. They were only able to seize about 5,000 Jews. And the remaining Jews built bunkers and hideouts for a defensive battle because they knew that the Nazis would come back and would retaliate. They collected weapons and ammunition through connections with the Polish underground, and they prepared for the attack. So this is from January onwards. Then finally, on the 19th of April 1943, led by SS General Jürgen Stroop, who I'll come back to in a minute, led the attack. Within 15 minutes, Jewish fighters retaliated, many with handmade weapons, and they forced the Germans to retreat on the first day. The Nazis changed tact and slowly destroyed the ghetto with flamethrowers, building by building, forcing Jews remaining in hiding to either appear or be killed. They held out for 27 days. After that initial attack, so on the 16th of May 1943, the uprising was finally crushed and the ghetto was destroyed, and the 42,000 survivors of the uprising were deported to concentration camps and death camps in the east. So that's kind of the macro level historical foundation about the Warsaw Ghetto. Jürgen Stroop is worth a special mention. He's not special himself, but you can get a hold of a book that's called The Stroop Report, which actually has photographic evidence, and it was photos that were taken by the Nazis throughout the destruction of the Warsaw Ghetto. That Stroop was then sending back to dispatches in Berlin, and showing, oh, this is how we're doing it, this is how we know we're crushing the Jews, and so on and so forth. And some of the photos are incredibly difficult to look at. You do see, for example, people jumping from buildings that are on fire, but it's a really valuable historical document because it's first-hand primary sources to see what was happening in the ghetto. And I just love the fact that you just get this image of the Nazis expecting to be able to stroll into the ghetto and just, deport all these Jews, and then being met with this wave of just huge resistance. And I love that. So now that we've covered the historical background for the Warsaw Ghetto, let's talk about the story. So, Shona Lee, without giving away any spoilers, could you give us an overview of the Fall of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Yes. Sorry. When you listen to all that information, it doesn't matter how familiar you are with it. The thing that always used to. This is a story that's not in the cycles. This is a story that I created from a fairy story that my bubba told me about the camps. And I filled in a lot of the details myself. It was done for a festival here, which is a big literature festival. Hay on Wye Literature Festival was the original reason for putting it together. And the thing that used to really get to me was when I was doing it, I was about Isaac's age. When I was first putting it together, the recording I think was done in 2007, I'm not sure. But when I first started thinking about it, and that was the same age as when I started to research as Mordecai and Lewitz, who was the leader of the resistance. And I had always thought of him as an old man. And to suddenly realize that he was the same age that my son is now was remarkable, really, and very inspiring and moving and sad. And then I got very angry because when you read some reports, they say, oh, he committed suicide. And he didn't. He didn't. But we won't go into that. But the story follows three children that are have befriended each other in the most unlikely of circumstances, and they have managed to hold out in a basement until the heat from the fires and everything are too much. And they're finally they come out into the streets and they're herded into one of the last wagons. In fact, there's only those three, and then an old man's thrown in as well. And it's an old man that they've seen around. He has a violin, and as the story says, a cloak dusty from the ruins, like beggar's velvet. And it's no spoiler to say that the old man is actually Elijah. Elijah the fool. Elijah the musician, Elijah the prophet, Elijah the magician, all of those guises come together in that wagon at the back of the wagon. And there's stories told, and a miracle happens. In some way, they get their lives back. And I don't want to tell you how, because that would be a plot spoiler. But of course, there's a price for everything. And towards the end of their lives, with the generations that wouldn't have been born, are born and are going about. One of them goes to America and plays for the movies. It's interesting, most of the violinists that did the, you know, all those tunes were Jewish violinists. Jewish musicians, because the skill to play that quickly, that chord, is synonymous with klezmer. And they meet up, and then they have to make a choice, and there's only one choice they can make. But it has a bittersweet, happy ending, if I can say that.
The listeners can't see my face, but as soon as you said, oh, the he wears a cloak like beggar's velvet, I immediately got a huge grin on my face because anyone who's heard you tell, who knows the stories, knows that as soon as a man wearing a coat or a cloak with like beggar's velvet turns up, we all know that's Elijah straight away. That's sort of
He's a
the key.
funky
So, do you have a favourite character? And or a favorite moment in the story.
I think David is my favourite character, the eldest boy, who gets given the violin of Elijah. I think he is my favorite character in the story. I love them all. I love them all, but he's my favorite, I think. What was the other question?
And any for any favorite moments
Moment.
or
Oh yeah, moment. There's just a moment between two characters that's repeated, and it's so understated. It's when David meets his wife on a film lot, and she's sneaking some chocolate. And chocolate, is something that as a boy he'd never had, and she'd never been to Europe, and she's sneaking this chocolate, and it echoes something that his mother has said to him about your sweetest sound of chocolate breaking. And it's just such an understated moment that holds so much. I think that's one of my favourite moments.
And I remember when I heard you tell the story, which, as an aside, I was an absolute wreck at the end of listening to, because it used to, you're right, it's such a, it's so, the ending is so bittersweet. And I remember one, and there's a phrase that you often tell us as listeners when we're with you, and it's something that your grandmother always said, and about outrageous hope. I wonder if you would share that with us now.
Not every story has a happy ending, but every story should begin with outrageous hope.
Oh, I'm gonna go. No. No, I'm not gonna. I must be. It must be professional. Professional host. Alex, do you want to ask the next one?
Yeah, I just need to get a hold of
Yeah,
myself.
she's.
Oh.
You got us all.
In light of just like, how hard it is. So are there any moments in the story that are like especially difficult that, you have to power through something like this that we're going through right now, or challenging either, for you as a storyteller or, for the audience?
Let me think. I think a moment where they have to make their decision at the end, when you tell a story, and what you must believe it. When you tell a story, if you don't believe it, you might just as well read the phone book. So when I'm telling a story, I believe every single word of it. Those characters are as real to me as you are right now. And when you tell a story a few times and there's something that you maybe don't want to happen, you always hope that maybe it'll end differently. And there's a moment where they have to make a choice. And I always hope maybe it will end differently. But it can't.
And that's the other thing as well, is again, not just with this story, but with other stories that I've heard you tell, we're on that journey with you, because we'll have, the Opal Forest is one of my oh, seriously, people need to, yeah, listen to it, and if you get the opportunity, please listen to a telling. But there are so many different stories that I've, for different reasons, been able to hear you tell more than once, and I know how it's going to end because I've heard you tell it. I know that there's not going to be a change, but we're walking with you and going, maybe this time, maybe it'll be different, maybe, even though we know it's not going to. And that's definitely one of the things that I love and appreciate with your telling. is that every story feels, and it, like you say, it comes from generations, it comes from a community. There are so many voices that have built that story. But it's still, every time you tell, it feels fresh. Like, this is the, you know, the story isn't old, but the words are new almost. So with that in mind, what would you say, coming back to the fall of the Warsaw Ghetto and the fact that it is a story about children and children are the protagonists, what would you say is the youngest age at which audience members could or should hear the story?
I'm tempted to say 14, but Isaac heard it when he was 12, but he's been brought up with story all of his life, you know. So what I normally say is 14 if I'm doing a performance, but if somebody contacts me and says, "Oh, I'd really like to bring my 12-year-old," I say, "Well, you know your child better than I do. These are some of the themes. If you're prepared to take responsibility, I won't stop that." But I don't think anyone under 12 I would tell it to.
Yeah, hard agree.
And what would you want audiences to walk away with in terms of its relevance for today, its contemporary relevance?
I think the inhumanity that we can bestow on one another, the resilience of the human spirit is incredible. And our capacity for compassion is more than we think. And I think we like to believe that we get better with each generation, you know. Oh, this would never happen now. You know, well, I've got news for you. And I think, if anything, for me, it's about dialogue, it's about discussion. You often, in the storytelling world, you get people going, "Oh, stories will change the world." And my bubble would say, "No, they won't. If stories would change the world would already have changed, because stories have been around for thousands of years." But what storytelling does, if we only realized it better than a lot of art forms, although I think art does it very, very well. But what storytelling can do is tell the difficult stories. And it can open up a space to have the difficult discussions. And maybe the tolerance to hear the difficult answers. And respect what you don't agree with. It's about giving a voice to the voiceless. It's about listening to all sides of an argument. And if you don't agree, learning to be tolerant, learning to walk away, learning to be compassionate, but also learning to stand up and be strong when that's the right thing to do as well. I think that's what I would want people to take away and build into their lives. And also, chocolate's really nice.
I agree, hard agree. So, if our listeners want to hear the story, where can they get a copy? Do you still perform it live? If people want to access, and honestly, I know it's been many years since I've heard it, and then Alex and I are going to listen to it, but I can say without a doubt, once you hear it, it stays with you. Especially the, and there's a particular visual element. When you hear it, you will know, but there's a particular visual element to the end that has stayed with me always. So if people want to experience that for themselves, how can they?
Well, I haven't performed it for a while, but you know, I get asked to occasionally do it, and I 90% of the time, if it's doable, I would say yes. I've got no performances planned for the next year. There is a CD, although my son reliably informs me that nobody has CDs these days, Mother. But I do, have some CDs that were made back in the time when dinosaurs roamed the earth. That if you went through my website and requested one, we could send it to you. But Simon's looking at setting up a Bandcamp so people could download it as well. We're still working on it because Bandcamp is for music. And he's going, oh, they want a band name. And I'm going, well, I'm not really a band, am I? Just me and my thousands of imaginary friends. So I might just put them up on Bandcamp as Shona Lee. So we're looking into Bandcamp as well.
Fantastic. Well, we'll put the link to your website in the show notes as well, so people can come and stalk you and see how they can sign up to get, to join a course, to come to a telling. Again, I have volunteered at one of your weekend tellings. They're amazing. I can, I'm not getting commission from this, by the way. She's not paying me. But they're just phenomenal because, yeah. That you really get a sense of the history as well, and kind of that sense of community and people coming around and listening and the learning, and also all the questions as well, because it's very interactive. It's not like theatre in, sort of, it's not performance in that regard. It's, that we can ask questions, we can say, you can say that's another story for another time. We can immediately put our hands up and go, but I want to hear it. And then, and it's just that element of it's energizing, and it's the community, and you really feel like come away feeling like you're part of something or have been part of something. It's equivalent to touching grass, really, just kind of coming back and being grounded. Like I said, I'm not on commission. She's not
I'm a
paying me for this.
storyteller. I haven't got the money. Although, are you going to come out in March to Amsterdam?
I was going to ask you about that and say whenabouts is that? Because I need to book. I need to make sure that I've got the time off. And but yes, of course, I'll come and do Zoom again. And this time it won't break down in the middle of the performance. And quick side note for you, Alex. So I've went out to Amsterdam to sort of do the online side for Shona Lee, and the computer threw an absolute hissy fit 2 minutes before she was due to start speaking. The room in person, we had about 60 people in the room, and there were some people online, and I was like, there's got to be a way around this. Come on, there's got to be a way around this. There was. I sat there and was a tripod and had my phone and just sat and
Like,
was
yeah.
filming Shona Lee on my phone.
Problem
It
solved.
worked. It
Yeah.
worked, but yeah, 13 out of 10 would not
So glad
recommend
you
for
were
stress
there.
levels. So, but yes, I will be there with bells, whistles, microphones, and 16 backup laptops. So yeah.
You message Nancy? Nancy knows when all the dates are.
Perfect. Back to Amsterdam.
Beautiful.
Anyway, back in the room. Alex, lovely, over to you.
So I know you said you're going to put it in the show notes. Is there, but where can people find you?
Shonalee.uk is my website. I have a professional Facebook page that is just Shonalee. Shonalee Cumbers is my private page, and I tend not to friend people on that because, you'll get all my private angst, my really weird sense of humour, and my political views, and that's not what people want. They want information about the stories. So Shonalee on Facebook. And also on Facebook, you've got Twilight Tales, the group, which has the link to the Twilight Tales and all about it. And that's a very dynamic group that so lots of conversations go on in there as well.
Beautiful. And
Oh, and we've got a children's book coming out.
oh, really?
Yes, should be out by Christmas. It's an illustrated children's book, and it's done in the do you remember the old-fashioned books with colour plates and stories, and so it's got, I think, about 18 stories and 12 color illustrations
Oh,
that are
beautiful.
done in the old-fashioned sort of nouveau style, and I love it, and I'm very excited about that. And it's called A Garment for the Moon.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. Yeah, so around Christmas, you said? Any particular publisher we should look out
Yes,
for?
it's Orkneyology Press,
Okay.
as in the Orkney Islands, Orkneyology Press, because they're a very small press, but they're very, very, what's the word when you've got principles? Well, they're very principled, and they've promised that they won't AI scrape any of it. So that's why
I
I'm
mean, they
going
better
with.
not. Some can't be
That's
taken out
why
by
I'm going with
these
Orkneyology Press.
guys. Beautiful. Well, shout out to them. Any final thoughts you would like our listeners to walk away with?
Just be kind.
Yeah. So say we all.
Yeah.
We all say that. Beautiful. Well, Sam.
So, Shanley, thank you so much. You know that we've wanted to have you on here and talk to you, and I'm so glad and thrilled that we finally have been able to do that. All of the information about your upcoming book, recordings, tellings, courses, weekend telling, everything. We'll put it all in the show notes. And yeah, Alex and I are going to go away and listen to The Fall of the Warsaw Ghetto. Based on how we all responded earlier, I think multiple boxes of tissues might be required. But so that's all from us for now. All I will say is, take care of each other, be kind, drink water, don't forget to take the recycling out. Alex, last words from you, lovely.
No, you said it. Yeah, give yourselves hugs, guys.
Yeah.
And each other hugs with consent.
And yeah, tune in for the next part when we will discuss our reactions to the fall of the Warsaw Ghetto. Thanks, guys.
Shanley, so nice meeting you.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.